Hello everybody and welcome to Europe United's Eastern Dialogue, which is a series of podcasts focusing on the many aspects and insights of Eastern European states located at the crossroads of Western Asia and the European Union. My name is Ken Sweeney and I'm joined by my co-host, Paris-based journalist Vikram Murajan, who is originally from Yerevan in Armenia. In this episode, we will be discussing the current political situation in Belarus and paying particular attention to how the country is dealing with the pandemic COVID-19. Our guest is Minsk-based journalist Hanna Lubakova. Despite recording over 17,000 cases, the Belarus administration under the control of long-term President Alexander Lukashenko has refused to follow the trends across the world and places country under severe safety measures. The question is, what is the current mood in Belarus and how will the lack of control measures impact on the country? We speak with journalist Hanna Lubakova about the current situation in Belarus and how Lukashenko's legacy and attachment to the presidential chair hinders the country's development. Hanna, welcome to Eastern Dialogue. And before we start, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're currently working on?
Sure. So my name is Hanna Lubakova. I'm from Belarus and I'm actually based in the country at the moment. I'm a freelance journalist, but I've recently joined Outriders, which is an international media platform that focuses on immersive and multimedia storytelling.
Okay.
So we publish, we're interested in foreign reporting from all over the world. We have journalists on different continents. And it's mostly foreign reporting, but we publish, right?
Yeah.
And I've joined as part of our latest project. It's called Radar. And it's an open source project that is looking for local solutions and responses to the coronavirus from, you know, various countries, from basically everywhere. We have now more than 300 responses from nearly every continent. So we are kind of collecting them, and it's the biggest global database of such. Well, it's gonna be, let's say, and I guess it's now already anyway. So we have journalists from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, obviously, and I'm mostly focusing on solutions journalism itself while doing this project. And so why we are doing this is because we want to obviously collect those responses and to show that a lot of good things are happening at the moment, obviously. And people, the pandemic has been a great motivator for people to self-organize and to bring solutions to the crisis. But we also want to help journalists find topics to write that they might be interested in and later write on them.
And can you ask you about the platform itself? Is it self-funded or do you have any assistance with any international funding or anything like that? Or do you do the funding yourselves?
So it's basically both. Mm-hmm. Outriders launched several years ago, around 2017 in Poland, and they managed to raise some dozens, I guess, thousands of euros. I don't remember how much it was exactly, but it was quite a lot for Poland, obviously. So it was a big crowdfunding campaign. And now we have grants as well from we collaborate with Google and Facebook, but we also have grants from the US mainly. So that's how we are.
And do you have a subscription for readers?
Oh, yes, we do, actually. We are launching so we are offering a chance for our readers to contribute as well. And we have this weekly, let's say, magazine that we distribute. Mm-hmm. It's called Brief, and it's quite popular. So people kind of are happy to read it. And then now we are launching the service so people can donate money to us directly.
Wow. So obviously, is it actually a non-profit organization? Is it listed as that or is it?
Oh, yeah, it is non-profit. Yes, it is non-profit. Right. So kind of, well, the main idea behind it was to start a project. Well, it was Poland. Imagine 3 years ago, right? Years ago. You know, like the situation back then and actually now, it was quite hard and difficult for media. And Outriders just wanted to kind of introduce some independent reporting, something new, so some new quality, because media there are very much divided between the political line. So Outriders are kind of, you know, beyond it, let's say. And once they launched the same year, they won the kind of main Polish award, which is called Grand Press, in the digital category.
So it's going places, in other words.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. 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 I mean, it's very exciting. It's obviously, we're similar. We have a similar situation with Europe United. That we're a non-profit organization. It's difficult enough when you're a non-profit to try and raise funds. So you have to be something different. Just looking at the website, it is very, you've got a very professional run website. It looks really good. Yeah, visually,
thank
it's
you.
Quite strong. So there's a lot of positive things about it. I mean, it's also, I think, you know, it's the definition of change with citizen journalism. No longer is it kind of people writing pamphlets and throwing them into shops and stuff like that. Citizen journalism has really kind of blended in, I think, a lot with professional journalism. It's a more cloudier thing now. There's not so much of a gap anymore, which I think is a positive thing because it allows people to have opportunities to write on professional platforms. So yeah, it looks really, really good. So I think what we'll do is we get back into the actual questions today. Vika, how are you? Just getting there, saying hello to you before we start.
Hello there. I hope everyone is doing fine. We're still under lockdown, but we already see the light in the end of the tunnel. And we wanted to talk with Hannah about Belarus because mm-hmm. Belarus has been recently on the news a lot.
Yes.
And wanted to maybe bust a couple of myths or understand what's happening in there. Hannah, so Belarus has had one of the least cases, the COVID-19 cases in the Eastern Partnership, if I'm not mistaken, in the beginning of the crisis. Mm-hmm. But right now, with reported total number of more than 70,000 cases, Belarus tops the block. And despite the growing crisis, also Belarus still wants to hold an annual military parade, while Russia and other post-Soviet countries have cancelled the Victory Day commemoration. So what does it say about your country's governance, and does Belarus risk becoming a new uncontrollable hotspot of the coronavirus in the Eastern Europe?
Yes, Vika, you are correct. Now we have the highest number of confirmed cases among all Eastern European partnership countries. We have more than 18,000. Confirmed cases, which is quite a lot, and the growth of new cases is also quite high. We have more than, let's say, 800, 900 people, new cases per day, which is really a lot. Despite that, it seems that Lukashenko is doing everything to make the situation even worse. You mentioned the military parade. We are still preparing for it. It's gonna happen on the 9th of May, which is the Victory Day. We are celebrating on that day, and we're gonna mark the 75th
anniversary year. Of the victory. Yeah.
Exactly of the victory at the Second World War. So there was an idea, like we had a lot of discussions whether we have to cancel the parade or not. And it obviously would be rational to do that because it's a mass event and it's very dangerous to have it at the moment. However, Lukashenko, I guess just yesterday or just, you know, recently, a few days ago, he said that no, he's not going to cancel it because people will not welcome this. And he said something like,
people will be scared. He doesn't want to scare people. That's why that's how he justifies the organization of this parade. And he actually even invited Russian officials to the parade in Belarus, which is very funny, while Russia didn't do the parade.
Exactly. So not only he invited Russian politicians, but he also kind of invited foreign leaders to travel to Belarus now and to participate in the parade, because I guess it will be the only country that is going to celebrate it. I mean, now in May. However, actually, today, one of those Russian politicians, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who is kind of very well known and veteran politician, he said that it's just crazy, it's insane what Lukashenko is doing. So he criticized him for doing this. I mean, the issue of parade is very interesting. Yes, you it's correct. He said that we don't want to be scared. We don't want to show that we are scared. And I think it's kind of very important for him. Paradoxically, a rational, collective, empathetic response to the coronavirus, which is to cancel mass events, means for Lukashenko means capitulation, disaster. This is also in line with what he said recently while playing ice hockey and making reference to the situation with the coronavirus. It's better to die standing than to live on your knees. So this is a very populistic rhetoric. Obviously, we can compare it to Bolsonaro, who also said that he's not gonna get infected because he's an athlete. So Lukashenko is also kind of trying to show that he is, you know, he's healthy, he's strong, we don't have anything to worry about, and like we will survive. It might be also a sign or kind of a smile, let's say, flirting to some Russians, those patriotic organizations, to show them that we are kind of better than Putin, we are better than Russia, in respecting our traditions, respecting our veterans.
But what's going to happen if, for example, the situation gets out of control? Do you think that your health system will be able to handle the crisis and will be able to keep it in the borders? Because Europe has suffered a lot, but the peak has passed. But it seems that in Belarus, the peak is just coming. So how do you think you're going to handle this uncontrollable growth of cases?
I think it's kind of now getting out of control already. We have quite tough situation in several places, such as Vitebsk, which is northeast of the country, where is one of the epicenters of the pandemic at the moment. And many hospitals there are being reprofiled, let's say, for having patients with the coronavirus, right? Yeah, I mean, the healthcare system now needs help, right? And it basically doesn't receive any help, let's say, from the authorities. It's volunteers who kind of self-organize and bring protective gear and masks to hospitals and like doctors, obviously. Now some of them are saying openly that the situation is really bad. Mm-hmm. So one doctor recently shared some facts, some insights and information with journalists that exactly that hospitals had not been resupplied to deal with the outbreak, and dozens of medical personnel had consequently fallen ill because they just didn't have means to protect themselves. And one of those doctors was recently dismissed, was recently fired. He was a chief physician at the Vitebsk City Emergency Hospital. His name is Sergei Lazar. He spoke out openly about, you know, hospitals that are overwhelmed and basically that the situation is really bad, and kind of there are several zones, like this red area at a hospital and then kind of clean area with other patients. And he was talking about that, like he shared all this information. He was subsequently fired, which is obviously, first it's bad because like we don't have
a lot of medical staff to support the...
Of course, you know, no country has enough. I mean, now, you know, when there is a pandemic. And another issue is obviously the atmosphere of fear, which is, you know, this is gonna bring more self-censorship, I guess, to people and to doctors and like to everyone, right? And I mean, anyway, no healthcare system can sustain, can fight the pandemic. That there is no country that can do that unless you control it, unless you kind of try to stop it. And Belarus is not doing this.
It's interesting that you have talked about this chief physician, Sergei Lazar, who spoke about Lukashenko and he got punished. Because a couple of days ago, I have seen that in the press freedom ranking in 2020, Belarus is on the 153rd position, which is way behind Russia. And Belarus is actually closer to North Korea than to the other Eastern Partnership countries. And we see that there's journalist Sergei Satsuk, who has been jailed because, again, spoke about Lukashenko. Can you tell me how is the situation with media in Belarus? How dangerous is it to be a journalist right now and in general? And how media organizations reacting to these restrictions while trying to do their job and be transparent with the public?
So you mentioned the case of Sergei Satsuk. He's an investigative journalist and he was arrested at the end of March when he published an article, a post in which he criticized the accuracy of the Ministry of Health's COVID-19 statistics. He said that they are just hiding the numbers and they are undermining the scale of it. So he was arrested and held in custody for, I guess, 10 days or something. And when he was released, in April, he announced that he will not publish any further investigations into the Ministry of Health anymore. So he got scared, and I guess he just kind of, you know, refused to investigate at least this field anymore. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is a deterrent for many people and many journalists, and will prevent them from looking into the COVID-19 situation in Belarus, right? Also, it's very important to mention that the Belarusian authorities recently came up with this idea to investigate those spreading false information about the pandemic, and the KGB, which is our secret services, are gonna deal with such people, right? As to the situation with media freedom in general, well,
you yourself worked in an independent media organization, right? If I'm not mistaken, in Belsat TV. Have you ever felt that pressure, like for example, editorial pressure saying, oh, you cannot cover the story because you know what's going
to
happen?
So yes, I used to work for Belsat TV, which is the only and still the first and the only independent TV station in Belarus, though it operates from Poland. It can't get a press accreditation in Belarus, inside the country, so it has to be based in Poland. And that's where I actually used to work. So I was literally based somewhere else. I was based in a neighboring country, right? And I was writing my stories, like publishing, broadcasting my materials under my name, but we had journalists in Belarus who had to work anonymously. So we kind of, our editorial policy, I was not censored in that sense. I wasn't told that I can't publish something because it's gonna criticize the authorities, because we were just in Poland, you know. I had nothing to kind of fear. However, mm-hmm. a lot of our journalists who were and still are in Belarus were fined. Belsat for working with Belsat TV. We have this really weird law on media which says that you either have to get accreditation or you just can't work as a freelancer, as a blogger, or as a journalist with a foreign media outlet without accreditation. So, mm-hmm. so they were kind of fined for that. And jointly, Belsat TV journalists were fined some $100,000, which is quite a lot.
Wow. So basically, he has a list of all the potential journalists who are working with, who are writing, who are freelancers, and he's able to control the whole flow of information.
Oh, yeah, totally. Lukashenko has never liked Belsat TV. He kind of talked about it in a very kind of negative sense, let's say. He criticized it a lot, and we kind of knew that we would never get press accreditation, and it was like one of the main issues for Lukashenko. I used to work for Radio Free Europe, and it has its office in Belarus and in Minsk, and it has some accreditations for journalists locally, so it's kind of in a better situation. We also have, you know, like Deutsche Welle that operates from like inside the country. So there are some foreign media, but like still, you probably would. I can't say that I had to self-censor myself, you know, when I worked for Radio Free Europe, but I was definitely threatened with some defamation suits or cases or some other issues. So it's not kind of easy. Also because of the lack of access to information, if you are a journalist who works for who work for an international or an independent media outlet, you will most probably denied access to information. Mm-hmm. Then you will be prevented from doing your work. Whatever, you can be arrested for any reason. I remember my colleagues were, you know, driving a car somewhere and, you know, going to do some reportage or whatever, and they were just, you know, stopped and they couldn't go because they had to go to a police office or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it happens quite often.
It's incredible. I actually used to watch Belsat TV because obviously my wife is Polish, so we have a Polish satellite system here, so Belsat TV was on our system, so we used to watch it a lot. And it was incredible because obviously you would see Belarusian TV and then you'd see Belsat TV, and the quality of broadcast and presentation was very different, you know. So like you could see that Belsat TV was quite a professional setup, and it was an unusual thing. I actually just wanted to ask you a couple of questions, Hannah, while I was there. With regards to Belarus, it seems to be from our side of the river, as we say here, that they continuously court the likes of China and Russia, when they also seem to be getting a lot of support from the European Union in terms of finance and also kind of grant aids and so on. Is that would that be a true image of what's happening there at the moment?
You mean this help, like
just in a general sense? Actually, I mean more in an allocation, say the way the EU allocates money per year through the Eastern Partnership and so on, but. You still think that, you know, from our point of view, we still see that, you know, Belarus continuously courting China and Russia in many other ways. Is that a regular thing? Is this a kind of like a cat and mouse sort of job that Lukashenko is playing?
Well, I guess the reason Belarus recently asked the EU for help, mm-hmm. Because of the coronavirus, and the EU kind of promised to give Belarus 60 million,
yeah.
60 million euros, yeah, I'm betting numbers.
No, don't worry,
totally.
I'm not good at numbers either, so don't worry.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, well, it can sound cynical because on the one hand, we don't have the coronavirus, it's called a psychosis here, mm-hmm. right? And then Belarus asks the EU for help, right? So there is kind of lack of logic. On the other hand, I mean, Belarus needs some funding, some additional yeah. money at the moment. And I think it will do quite a lot to get it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the condition of the Belarusian economy, which is still based on ineffective methods of planning and management, which are, you know, coming from the Soviet Union, is quite tough, I'd say. The growth of economy is very low, and the economic situation became even worse, let's say, because since mid-2018, Russia has been increasing the rate at which it's reducing, right, its subsidies, and there was an issue with oil price, and these subsidies from Russia are among the main drivers of economic growth, mm-hmm. generally, and are conditions for the stability of the Belarusian economy, right? Let me just talk briefly about that, because that might be interesting in terms of future reforms and kind of our will, like the Belarusian authorities' will to collaborate with the West. Mm. So a few years ago, there was a progress and some growth of our economy, which I remember was celebrated widely, and people were kind of justifying the Lukashenko's politics, yeah. and like he was praised for that. But the problem that with this progress was that it was largely achieved with borrowed money, and the country of Belarus has been spending more than it earns, and it just borrows more and more money. It just takes, you know, yeah. more and more loans to cover the gap between earnings and spending, right? So there was some progress in terms of that, because we needed some loans from the International Monetary Fund and from the European Union as well. And the government has reduced support for some state-owned enterprises a few years ago. But still, whenever a factory or an enterprise needs some money or is just losing money, some kind of loan and subsidy is being, you know, given to, mm-hmm. to that enterprise.
And in regards to the Eastern Partnership arrangement that it's in, Could you do you think that generally the Belarusian administration is in it just to kind of just for the sake of it, and that they really don't have any intentions to make the reforms that are required in the long run? Is the EAP, in other words, is it just a game to make Russia to annoy Russia or to make them sort of jealous or something like that? Or am I thinking too much into that?
Well, I mean, Belarus has to introduce some reforms anyway. Belarus will have to close the gap between spending and earnings. And because the situation is going to be worse, our public debt may rise to some 70% of our GDP. It's really a lot. And it's just a matter of whether these reforms are going to be planned and structured, or they will be unplanned and unstructured, which is going to be even worse for the people. We currently have very low heating tariffs, which has also been, another reason for public borrowing, which is already quite high. And I mean, those low tariffs are obviously good for people of low income. It's understandable, but it just kind of makes us even more indebted. And I mean, this is like, these were conditions of the International Monetary Fund or, other organizations to kind of introduce those reforms to get more loans, to get more credits and so on. And Belarus will eventually have to do that to some extent anyway. Like 5 years ago, there was this kind of small reform when the government, as I mentioned, reduced support for state-owned enterprises. So they will have to gradually do that. Another issue is that, well, it might endanger the Lukashenko's position. Because you might remember in 2017, we had this protest. People were protesting against the law on unemployed in Belarus. So like thousands of people across the country took to the streets to protest. And it was kind of, Lukashenko felt kind of vulnerable, I guess, and quite stressed at that moment, because he kind of first that year, he kind of stopped that law, like the law didn't exist. But he later, actually, like 1 year later, he reintroduced the law again, but it was just very kind of it looked differently. So you can see that if we have, we have this special social contract in Belarus, people will receive their pensions, that they might be very low, that might not be enough, but they receive them every month, and they have what they have. They're not obviously rich or anything like that, but like they still can live on what they receive, and that's the social contract. And when we have those reforms, when we will have our state enterprises will not be subsidized, they might bankrupt and people will lose their jobs, it might be a reason for people to come to take to the streets to protest, which is not good for Lukashenko, and he might be scared of that. So, but our economy will definitely needs some reforms.
Hannah, do you think that this crisis really can weaken the power of Lukashenko? And the most importantly, if it happens, does Belarus have a strong opposition who can take on the governance, or have all kinds of opposition powers been suffocated by him before?
So firstly, what we are observing now is that, I think it might be very important to mention that activists are now playing the state's role, which I'm kind of not surprised, because we've been doing this for years. Whenever the government says that the crisis is not coming, it is definitely coming. So people kind of self-organize. They, I can't say that they don't listen to the authorities, but it just might seem for someone who is not in Belarus or not from Belarus that Lukashenko is in control of everything. He kind of is, but people have their own, street smartness. They decide on themselves. And this current crisis, the coronavirus crisis, showed that Lukashenko's leadership, his authority, is not that strong, let's say, as we might imagine.
He has been president since 1994. Does he have anything more to give to the Belarusian people? Or I think every president, however good they may be, they just have an expiration date and everybody understands that it's time for him to leave, but he doesn't want.
Well, he's been playing with this message of, you know, stability and like, you guys have your jobs, you have your pensions, the situation is stable. Look at Ukraine. You know, he's been saying like for the past years, look at what's happening there. Do you want to have the same in Belarus? So it kind of works. And yeah, I mean, I mentioned that before, like we don't have much, but we just have it, you know, every month we have a stable system, let's say, which might be stable on the surface only, but like whatever. So however, this crisis, yeah, I mean, it's showing that only illustrate the errors of Lukashenko and his lack of leadership at the moment. However, it might not have political effects for Lukashenko, simply because, firstly, there is no mechanism. There are no tools to bring about changes in Belarus. How are people going to bring them? Like, are they going to go and protest? Well, I mean, protests in Belarus can be easily dispersed because, you know, we have a very strong repressive system and law enforcement system in Belarus, nor will the economic crisis cause protests, since people will not solely blame Lukashenko for the crisis, because the rest of the world will be counting costs of the pandemic as well. So in that case, Lukashenko might only win. Belarus was predicted to have a recession this year by the World Bank. And it definitely will now. And however, since other countries will have it as well, most probably, you know, we will not look that bad comparing to them. So even despite the lockdown, you know, we will have a bad economic situation. But in any case, I'd say that the current situation is probably the hardest challenge that Lukashenko has ever dealt with.
I hope this will be a buzz for him to, you know, wake up and understand what has been doing with the country.
Well, in that case, I'm not that optimistic.
That was honest. I understand that there are a lot of Russian people living in Belarus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why maybe the country, the population is more inclined to working with Russia and staying friends with Russia instead of trying to cooperate more with Europe, with European countries, with the EU. But it's very difficult to understand really the true nature of the relationship between Belarus and Russia. Is it like a codependency? Is it a friendship? Because recently you had problems regarding the oil prices and Belarus like turned to other countries were seeking for oil. So can you help us a bit elaborate on, for the European listeners, how can we define the true nature of the relationship between Belarus and Russia?
So it's definitely correct that Belarus kind of looks on Russia in whatever it does, because geopolitically, economically, socially, historically, we've been tightened with Russia, and it's very hard to change our course, you know, just overnight. However, well, recently, you know, the whole kind of discord, the whole discontent between Belarus and Russia only showed that it's kind of a facade of friendly relations, but the facts tell a different story, that there are no subsidies, there is no friendship. In the beginning of last month, in April, Belarus finally reached an agreement with Russia in terms of oil prices, and it's going to buy crude oil at a quite cheap price, and it's not going to pay the premium, which was one of the conditions that, like, it was a matter of principle for Lukashenko not to pay premium to Russian suppliers. So now, for now, it looks okay, right? We agreed on something, we reached a compromise. However, just in the beginning of this year, Russia obviously stopped in exporting oil to Belarus, right, to Belarusian refineries, because the two countries didn't agree over pricing. And Belarus obviously had to import crude from Norway and Azerbaijan, right? So that confrontation between Belarus and Russia over oil revenues, but also over political integration, did deliver a serious blow to this long-standing alliance, let's say. I must say that it's not the first time when it happened, this conflict over oil. In 2002, as far as I remember, Putin took a very radical stand when he proposed that Belarus' six regions would become regions of the Russian Federation. But back then, this idea kind of disappeared. We have this, you know, union treaty, and it kind of disappeared, and Lukashenko kept continuing receiving payouts from Russia. But last year and a half ago, it became a kind of very serious issue for Moscow. And Moscow's official position was, well, different gas prices require different level of integration between the two countries. And now we come to a situation when obviously independence is way more important for Belarus than let's say, its economic stability. And I guess the main reason is not because Lukashenko is... And I have to mention that he's taking care of the country, but it's just because he is very much afraid of losing power, and that's very important. So that was a kind of very important financial matter. And Lukashenko had to kind of look for solutions, but as he understood that he was not able to convince Russia to come back to the previous model of, you know, getting subsidies, getting oil prices and so on, well, it became really tough. And our kind of state budget and the public sector is partially subsidized by the money from oil refineries. So this is, this is very important, right? And that lack of agreement only demonstrate the gradual breakdown of Russian-Belarusian brotherhood. So we can now expect that Belarus will try to establish more rational and balanced relations, both with Russia and the West. It might play around continue flirting with the West and agree, you know, to some reforms, even probably political. Mm-hmm. Let's see. But it will also continue, trying to maintain good relationship with Russia, because it's just, you know, crucial.
Hannah, do you think that at the end of the day, democracy full democracy is a long way away from happening in Belarus?
I think with Lukashenko, obviously, we can't. So there is little chance of democratization, mm-hmm. as long as Lukashenko remains in power.
And for the moment, do you think that him being in power is probably a good thing in terms of keeping stability? Because if you probably had, you know, if a democratic election, say, for example, and there was infighting between parties and so on, would that not be bad for the situation that's currently happening? So is it probably a good idea to keep the status quo in Belarus for the time being, given the fact that the pandemic is out there?
Well, Lukashenko is, well, firstly, economically, in terms of our economy and, you know, bad situation, mm-hmm. Lukashenko is the one who's been single-handedly managing the economy. And he's the one who is... let's say the reason of the crisis, right? And let's just remember that he's not the one who is saving, saving the country. He is just balancing between Russia and the West, and he's just saving his power. Our opposition is obviously very weak, and the current crisis only shows that they are not able to self-organize, to engage with people, to make people interested in their agendas, let's say. There is obviously an alternative. I can say that there are no people who can be an alternative to Lukashenko, but it's just very hard to kind of for them to
mobilize
at the moment. Yes, we have volunteers, and we have civil society, and we can see how important they are becoming and how much trust they are gaining at the moment. They are now playing the state's role, right? They are now the ones mm-hmm. who are trusted and who people want to, you know, help, you know, join and so on. But whether they will become a political power, I mm-hmm. can't say. It's very hard to say. But it will definitely have some consequences, and people will trust non-governmental organizations more. But it's very early to say that.
Yeah, and I think it's the situation across Europe is that really nobody knows what the next 18 months are going to be like anyway. So, you know, in its own way, I presume that Belarus is suffering from that situation as well, you know, in its own unique way.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's a short answer. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult situation. No one knows where they are, and you have these consequences of what is going to happen. Hannah, listen, thanks very much for taking the time out to talk to us today. It's been a really interesting listening to you, because obviously, as I said, we have a lot of listeners back in Ireland, the UK, and in certain parts of Europe who wouldn't know what's going on in countries like Belarus. So it's really important that we get these get the information out there. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today and give us all that information. Just to go at again, the media platform that you write for is Outriders, mm-hmm. and you can find them at outride.rs. Is that right? That's the website, isn't it? Outride.rs. If you look that up, you'll find that.
Yes, exactly. Just Google Outriders Poland or something, and then you will find it.
Great. And just one more thing, but I just wanted to ask you, which maybe you can confirm. People can actually submit work to Outriders, isn't that right? If you have local people who wanted to, who are interested in writing for your organization, they can send that in. Is that correct?
Well, yes, we obviously accept mm-hmm. pitches and so on. But like our rather project, we are accepting responses and information. Brilliant. About local initiatives from different countries. So people can easily submit it. It's rather Outriders. If you Google that, you will see. It's quite straightforward. It looks very easy. We are welcoming, obviously, pitches and responses and initiatives.
Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to join us today. This is episode 4 of Europe United's Eastern Dialogue. My name is Ken Sweeney, and I have my good colleague Vika.
Hey there.
Are you ready to say goodbye?
Yeah, and talk to you very soon about new interesting topics, and let's uncover together the Eastern Partnership region.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. Thanks a lot. By the way, you can check us out, of course, at europeunited.eu, and we are also on Facebook at europeunited.eu. And finally, we're also on Twitter at europeunited.eu. So thanks again for listening to us. This has been episode 4. We'll see you real soon. Stay indoors and stay safe. And as Rafi said last time round, wash your hands. Take care, guys. Goodbye. Bye-bye.